Hey, how's it going? I'm Nick, the host of the Echo Academy podcast, a podcast where we share with you the tools and strategies that make life better. This series is all about the road less traveled. And in this episode, we speak to the founder and CEO of Uncommon, Yolanda Lee. Yolanda shares her story of taking a break from university to work as a production assistant in the music industry for a major label techno DJ, including touring with them, before going back to graduate and moving to Africa to set up the first e-commerce company in the continent before landing in Singapore. I hope you enjoy her story. It's really interesting to talk with, you know, founders in general, but I'm curious, you know, for someone who's had, you know, your level of success in the corporate world, what are kind of the driving factors that get you to start your own gig, and then after that we can kind of delve into your history.
Yeah, sure. The driving factors to start my own gig, you know, it was a long process. I think sometimes people see, you know, the outcome and it seems very like, oh, it was just sort of a decision that was made. Like, I think I always had a sense of wanting to do my own thing, but being very afraid of it. I think for a variety of reasons. Like, I think, you know, I'm the kid of immigrants to Canada, and you know, they were just optimizing for stability, and I had a much more sort of privileged upbringing than my parents did, and just feeling the weight of that sacrifice. And I think this is something like a lot of sort of, whether it's, you know, kids of immigrants or the sort of first generation of success, you feel this like weight of stability and privilege. And so it took me a very long time to get there. I think it was a few things. I think I had done three growth stage like tech unicorns. And I think after a while I was like, maybe I don't want to do this. I think my third one, I was sort of like, okay, I don't need to do this again. And right. So that opened up the question of, okay, what now? And I spent probably a year trying to figure that out. I worked with a coach. I interviewed, like, no, interviewing is a great way to understand, you know, what do you like, what do you not like. I went to like bigger corporates. I was like, maybe I want to go to tech retirement, or maybe I want to go, you know, very early stage. And so I think it was like this year of kind of self discovery, but ultimately coming back to the point that I was at a stage in my life where maybe I had an appetite for risk that I didn't necessarily think I would always have, and I needed to seize that opportunity. And also feeling a bit like I wanted to come back to my roots of being really impact and purpose driven. And when we get into my backstory, I can take you through that. But I always thought I was, you know, when I studied at university, I was going to work at the World Bank or the United Nations like that. Yeah. And I did all my internships like thinking I was going to go down that path. And so I think coming full circle and saying, okay, what is the mark I want to leave on the world? And kind of coming back to that.
Yeah. Yeah, I suppose those are really important things to think about. And it's funny how we revisit it every now and then when things don't feel so aligned. So it's also interesting because you mentioned, you know, growing up, your parents optimized for stability. That's a really interesting phrase I've not heard before. I don't know if it's common, but you also told me before the podcast that, you know, you dropped out of university. And so if your parents optimized for stability, how did they feel about that decision?
Yeah. I mean, the long-term decision or the short-term? So I eventually did go back to university, go to grad school. So, you know, they're still speaking to me. But
At that moment, take us through that.
Yeah, so I had done 1 year of university in Canada, where I'm from, and I got back to, so it was outside, it was outside of the city. I grew up in Toronto. It was outside of the city. It was not the right fit for me for a variety of reasons. I think I'm a big city person in general, but also I had wanted university to expand my horizons, and it was essentially all the people I went to high school with. My older brother was there. It was a very, I always joke that this university was like the university you see in American movies with like the sorority girls and the fact, and which like, if you knew me, is like really not my vibe. And so I got back to the city and I was young. I mean, I was 17 or 18. I'd done 1 year of university there, and I grew up with particularly strict parents, and I got back and I was like, I want to go to art school or do something else or study, you know, elsewhere, like outside of Canada or something. And my parents were very strict in the sense that they were like, either you go back or we are cutting you off financially. Which is really one of these like pivotal moments in my life. And I did have a part-time job at the time, but it was a defining moment in that I decided to be cut off financially. I had never lived alone. I had never paid bills. I had no idea how to budget. I was making like $9 an hour, yeah. Like before taxes, which in Canada is like relatively high. So I moved out that summer, and my intention was always to go back to university. Like for me, I always understood, you know, the value of it, but I think I needed that space to chart my own path and to stay true to my values. So it was a hectic, I spent 2 years out of university, but I still think it like is the defining feature of my character, is that I took that like difficult path. So I was working. I probably had like, it was probably the hardest I've ever worked until I have a startup now. I worked in a store. I worked in, you know, I would do random things like do the door at like club. Like I had a lot of random jobs.
It took to survive. Yeah, right?
Exactly. Yeah. I mean, I lived in a 2-bedroom apartment with there were three of us. We would sort of like rotate. We were all friends from high school, but it was an interesting time, but it really taught me like the value of money as well. I think it is sometimes what drives me, because even though I've moved through my career and earned more money, like there is still this side of me that's like, oh my gosh, I remember when I couldn't withdraw money from my bank account because the minimum withdrawal in Canadian bank machines is $20, and I had less than $20 in my bank account. And like, yeah, and just like not being able to pay for stuff. And so that in many ways, like having that experience can be such a motivator in some ways. But what happened was I was very interested in the arts. I had no idea how commercial models around that worked. But my friends and I, this is when real estate was much cheaper in Toronto than it is now, but my friends and I had rented this space that we thought we could partially live in and partially have as a art gallery. And none of us knowing, you know, I was 18, none of us knowing what the commercial model of like an art gallery, how you make money in an art gallery works. And it was sort of this industrial space, which sounds somewhat glamorous because now you see like Brooklyn lofts that are really nice. No, it was not.
It's like all
that.
The rage had, now, right?
Yeah, we totally had rats and it was just disgusting and bed bugs and like, it was not cute. But it was in the center of Toronto. It was this cool space. And then we started realizing, shoot, we need to pay rent. How are we going to do this? And we started throwing concerts. And it was partially like a timing thing, because on one hand, like in Toronto, you have a 2 a.m. like hard cutoff of alcohol, a bit like how in Singapore we have 30 cutoff right now. But like Toronto just has that even pre-COVID, like 2 a.m. cutoff. And so people would sort of be looking for something like after parties, and we would, I'm going to show my age, we would message like DJs who were doing shows in Toronto on MySpace, which was a social network for all the young people. It was this like social network before Facebook, where you could have like top friends, and like there were a lot of bands and music on it, and you could just directly communicate with DJs and bands, and you would message them and be like, "Do you want to do a show?" And it kind of gradually, that was my foray into the music industry, and then kind of like worked as like part of a booking agency. And it was sort of as electronic music was really taking off at that time. And we had some big acts do shows there, from like Daft Punk.
What year was this?
It's sort of, this is 2006.
Okay. Yeah. It really was taking off.
Yeah, exactly. And so it was, like now some pretty big acts, like the guys from Major Lazer, Daft Punk, all these now huge acts, but at the time had like played essentially at our house. And so that I essentially got then hired by one of the artists to kind of work as a production assistant on tour. And that's what moved me out of Toronto, which at the time was like my biggest goal, was I wanted to move out. And I spent a year kind of on tour with some techno DJs.
Wow.
Who were pretty big in their scene. And we would go, you know, to Fuji Rocks Festival, Coachella. Like, it was a pretty cool gap year in many ways. That was what I spent my time off doing. It was a great way to see the world, because I hadn't grown up really traveling that much. I think I went on an airplane for the first time when I was 11. And so it was this incredible way to see the world at such a young age.
Yeah. Excuse me. Something you said, and this is one of the reasons why I really wanted to do this series, is because I'm hearing a recurring trend among all the speakers about how you just had an idea of what you wanted to do, but nothing was really set in stone. It was kind of figuring out along the way. I have two questions just from that. Sure. The first one is, how did you feel as you were figuring things out? You know, talk us through the good and bad. And then the second part of it was, what did you learn about yourself through this process?
Yeah. Okay. Both really good questions. So the good and the bad, it's true that you can sometimes look back on your experience and see, you know, the outcome and look at it with rose tinted glasses. But I definitely went through the highs and the lows. Like, there was this high of like, for the first time in my life, being independent and surviving and proving not just to myself, but to, you know, my parents and everything, that I could survive. So that was the high, and I could take risks and they could work out. The lows, you know, definitely a lot of anxiety. I think a lot of fear, and a lot of, you know, now I can look back in hindsight and know that everything kind of worked out, but I felt like this immense stress and grief and fear around, am I going to be like a failure? Am I going to like kind of let down everything around me? Like, my parents had sacrificed so much for my education, for giving me a life that was better than theirs. And there was this feeling of like, am I squandering that? Which comes with, I think, quite a lot of guilt and just not very good feelings. So it's true that like, I often listen to podcasts and I think, oh, they're telling it like looking back, and it sounds like such a rosy picture, but I think it's really important to be real about that, is that I don't know why I had just such a strong sense that I needed to do things my own way in some ways. And that I needed that breathing space to have some wild and crazy years. And then, I don't know, I think there's a lot of, I still question why I wasn't just like, didn't take the take the red pill or the, whatever you call it, like take the other path, because it would have been a lot easier. But I did have this very strong sense of needing to, needing to make things better. But what I learned, kind of came to what I learned from this, I think the strongest or the most powerful learning I have from this experience is that amongst the chaos, and it really was chaos at times, and amongst the that free fall kind of feeling of chaos when things go poorly or where you don't know where things are going to turn out, that it gave me that confidence to be able to navigate those uncharted waters, and at least that confidence to know that, okay, if you get knocked down, that ability to get back up and to continue to put myself in scenarios that I don't have all the answers, that it's not, that I don't have, I might not have any of the answers. And I think it's that ability to say yes to opportunities that I have no idea how I'm going to do it, but still that deep innate confidence that I will figure it out somehow.
Yeah. And what sort of opportunities kind of resonate with you, in the sense that, you know, even if you don't know what the answer, what the future holds, like, you still say yes to?
Definitely entrepreneurship now. I think that there was a certain baseline of like stability I felt like I needed to save and invest just to feel comfortable to take this risk. But once I did that, then the hardest step that's not true. There's a lot of hard steps, but one of the hardest steps is really taking that leap. And so much of entrepreneurship, like, you need to let go of that feeling of like, I am going to know everything and it's going to be perfect. And even as you start to kind of put your products out to the world, like, you've got to let go of like, oh, this is going to be exactly, so much of it is hypothesis led, but you also are proven wrong. Your hypothesis is often proven wrong. So that's definitely been one element. But then also, you know, I've had a pretty unconventional career. I had mentioned, like, after my time in the music industry, I then took a turn of saying, okay, I had seen the world and I had seen that I wanted to have an impact, and that I wanted an international career, which no one in my family really had, with a few exceptions. So I wanted to work in international development. Like, I studied development economics and did internships with like the European Court of Human Rights and all these sort of things, like, to kind of put me on that path. And I think when I was doing my master's research, which was in Kenya, I had seen, so Kenya, that you have this incredible mobile payments product called M-Pesa, which I think at the time had like 89% penetration. You don't even need a smartphone. You can SMS your money to like a farmer in rural Kenya. It's pretty amazing. And I just saw the impact that technology could have to change lives. And that's really where my foray into tech came from, was like ultimately from this purpose-driven place. And that's why I started my tech career in Africa, which isn't very common.
So tell us a little bit about that. So how did you make that decision, and what did you do?
I'm also going to be brutally honest. I was at grad school in the UK, and then my visa was running out. I had actually wanted to stay in the UK, but like Theresa May had just like passed the law that like highly skilled workers can't live anymore. Shout out to Theresa May. And she had been on this whole tip about like the best and the brightest like should stay in the UK, but I literally finished top of my class at Oxford and she still didn't let me stay. So I don't know what it would have taken.
What's higher than that? I mean, it's like, a very high bar.
Yeah, I know. I should have written her a letter. Never did. So there was that. I really wanted to stay in the UK, couldn't. And then I also had like never really worked in emerging markets, and I was always, you know, having studied in developing world, done my research there, I really wanted to get out of my comfort zone of the Western world. So I was applying for things all over the world. And I had a friend who was working at Rocket Internet in Nigeria, a childhood friend. And she helped me. I had applied. She had connected me to someone there. And I mean, it happened very quickly where I got the offer, and then 2 weeks later, I mean, I had to fly back to Canada to get my visa, and I was on the ground 2 weeks later. And it was just sort of saying yes to these opportunities that I think would have given me they scared me in a lot of ways, but ultimately gave me so much more growth and learning. I think I still could have done an entry level consulting job, which is also what I was applying for. But I think, joining, it was also, again, a timing thing, because Rocket Internet had just decided that they were, very recently before, they were going to expand in Africa, and they were hiring crazy. And so they were doing kind of the e-commerce, Lazada model in Africa called Jumia, which was one of the first kind of now tech unicorns in Africa. But yeah, you're really the first, you're not just first mover, you're really creating the first tech businesses, yeah, much like
the infrastructure.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. I mean, I remember doing rider trainings and being okay, you are the blue dot. And when the blue dot moves forward, you're moving forward. It's that level of market education. And moved to West Africa. So I spent a lot of time in Ghana, was in Nigeria. And I mean, I had no idea what I was doing. I had not really led a team. I had not managed a P&L. I remember getting screamed at for not having, I mean, that was also the style of the company. But it gave me immense opportunity for growth. I was in my early mid-20s, and you're managing massive budgets. And I'm just very happy that I had that opportunity to learn, because I don't think joining, the other options I had on the table, which were very entry level roles in developing organizations where nothing against consultants, but it was just a very different path. And it gave me that opportunity to put myself in a market I had no understanding of and figure it out. And definitely called my parents crying so many times. Definitely worked harder than I've ever worked in my life. But it was optimizing your career for growth and not necessarily for title or for brand or anything like that. It was
can you explain that? What does optimizing for growth mean?
I think it's about personal growth. How many skills are you going to have the opportunity to learn? And when I looked at the job scope of some of the other things I had, I was okay, I'm going to make PowerPoint decks. Cool. and then I looked at this, and it was I'm going to build a company from the ground up. I'm going to build a team from the ground up. I'm going to make decisions. I'm going to have that agency to have that impact. And I'm going to learn. Yeah, I still think having that operational experience on the ground has defined my career. And I wouldn't have had the opportunities I had after that had I not taken that leap and put myself in that position to really be uncomfortable. And learning to sit with that discomfort and figure it out through that discomfort has really served me throughout the rest of my career. Yeah.
Yeah. Wow. That's such an interesting experience. It's hard for me to imagine. And so maybe it would help for me to ask, when you go for opportunities like this, let's say in Africa, it's a new market. People are still figuring out. You are still figuring things out. What are some of those moments where you thought to yourself, because you spoke about, you calling your parents and crying? Like, what were some of those moments where you felt like you wanted to give up, and what changed your mind?
I mean, I called my parents crying. Let me think. I mean, the macro was just I was working so hard, like, you know, 7 days a week, like long hours. And there was that just like level of stress. Then there was, I mean, the challenge with working in these very frontier markets is just, you need to learn to choose your battles. And, you know, I almost sometimes forget it, because I like living in Singapore. It's so efficient. Things work. There's not corruption. Like, at least on a, yeah. And I think it was hard for me to adjust to like choosing my battles. Like, it took us 9 months to open a bank account.
Wow.
and that's 9 months of like going into the bank every day and like yelling, and and just, yeah, there's so many touch points in your day that can kind of, yeah, set you off and be really frustrating, and you're like, why doesn't this work? And so that was something I had to learn, is that if I was going to like blow a fuse every time I asked something to be done and it wasn't done, and or something got lost, or you ordered your meal and it never came at a restaurant, which happened so often. Like, if I was getting angry at all of these small touch points, I was never going to have the energy to make like the big things work. So I think, yeah, it was about focusing.
Yeah,
about learning. And I learned that the hard way, because I think I went in sort of guns blazing and and needed to recalibrate a bit. I think it was also, I mean, there was some really big challenge. I mean, there's a lot of big challenges. I'm trying to think which one I want to focus on. There were a lot of systemic challenges of like dealing with, I don't want to like bash the government there, but
don't worry.
You know, it was sort of like a lot of challenges you don't need to deal with, like administratively, yeah. And you know, corruption on, I can speak generally about like dealing with that level of corruption that would kind of show up in so many places, even in countries that are sort of hailed as the, you know, the democratic, like great, good governance,
yeah, yeah.
Like, on paper and like all the reports, and you're like, nah, that's not true. But I think it was also being under, like, I had a strong sense. I feel like I have this less, and I don't necessarily know how healthy it is, but I had a strong sense of like proving people wrong.
Right.
And that's okay. It can be a double-edged sword. It can be really motivating, but I think there's a lot of people, especially, you know, I was a young single foreigner, and a lot of people took, and I was one of the four female country managers at my venture at Rocket Internet, and I think a lot of people sort of discount your capabilities, or if something went really wrong, it would be attributed to like the way you look or your charm. And so I think I had a big sense of like needing to prove myself. And I don't think that's always healthy as you move forward, because then you're always kind of trying to prove yourself to someone. You should really only hold yourself
yeah.
accountable to the things that matter. But definitely early in my career, I felt like I would go into boardrooms at sometimes, and people would be like, come back when you have a husband. I'm like, I still don't have one. And that would be really disheartening, but then it would also be this motivator of like,
yeah.
Okay, I'm going to use the fact that I'm underestimated to show that you shouldn't underestimate me.
Yeah, good for you. That's powerful. I mean, and I can't even imagine what someone saying, you know, come back when you have a husband sounds like. It just seems so, I mean, I would have blown a fuse if that someone had said that to me. So I'm lost for words. I can't even, I mean, this is not an experience that I can imagine. And yeah, wow. So using your experience, you know, going through making that decision, that leap of faith to drop out of university, to explore that life as a techno DJ tour manager, to sharing with riders in Africa, you know, how to set things up. What do you think is the value of those uncommon experiences? How has it made you the person that you are today?
Good. That's a really good question. A few things. I think collecting really different experiences has given me, I think, a flexibility in my perspective. I think, you know, I've lived and worked in now, I've actually lived in 10 countries across like Asia, Africa, Europe, North America, very different places. But I think the more diverse experiences you have, you actually see the similarities in humans more than the differences. So that's been a big one, is like, I think by and large, people all want the same things. They want to feel safe. They want to feel understood. They want to feel like they belong. Those are just the like core human needs. And yes, we may have like different icing on the cake, but like it's still by and large very similar. Those needs don't change. And I think being able to collect those difference of experiences has helped me to see actually the similarities in people versus the differences. I think it has also, coming back to perspective, like made me, I think when I first started working out of my home country, I related everything back to my experience being sort of what I compared everything to. Well, this was like the normal way of doing it and everyone else like is different. And I think that's not true. Like I think also working for big tech companies like Uber and Deliveroo that have headquarters like in the West, but I've always worked in their kind of frontier or their external markets. I've never worked in head offices. And so that helped me to think a lot about localization and the importance of that in a business and the importance in listening to your customers, not just as a data point, but really thinking of the broader context and building products for your customers around the world. And it can't just be, I think a lot of companies honestly waste a lot of time and money and resource on trying to like copy paste a model from like another market and be like, oh, they speak English. Let's like just do exactly that. And you're like, that is like so not how it works. And I still think like a lot of companies some do get localization well. They just think like, okay, I'll translate the website. And then others really don't. And so that's been another learning, is to have that humility to understand different perspectives, different approaches, and not come at a situation with like my own experience being at the center of it, which takes, I think, a lot of humility, to be honest.
It's, I really learned something from you today, Yolanda, which is just because it isn't the normal way of doing things doesn't mean it's not normal. I guess I forget that a lot too, just because it's not something that I'm used to, that this is not how it should be done. And yeah, I think that's a good philosophy for integrating into anywhere and adapting to a lifestyle that's different from yours or connecting with people who are different from you. So I'm going to remember that.
Yeah, okay.
last question before I let you go. I know we spoke about it before we started recording, but what are you up to now and what's your plans?
Yeah, so I am I am currently building so I'm launching my startup Uncommon. It is a private leadership network for the next generation of female leaders in Asia. This was really born out of my experience as a female leader, going through the ranks. And I think I talked about some of those experiences, but I started to see, you know, whilst there were a lot of kind of community groups for women, I saw in this sort of mid-career, so looking at kind of director level and beyond, that there wasn't a lot of support and the approach was really, yeah, there wasn't a lot of support like focused on this segment of female leaders. And it can be a particularly challenging part of the journey as a leader, because often, you know, you've achieved a certain level of success. There's, you know, certain kind of biological life stages that women go through, and that's honestly in Singapore where we see and beyond, you know, across the world where we see the biggest drop off in women in leadership.
Yeah.
And so I came from that starting point and also saw that, you know, the way I was witnessing women, female leaders connecting was fundamentally different from the tools that existed out there. There was, I got a lot of feedback. So during COVID-19, I was interviewing a lot of women. I saw a lot of women, you know, hating large network events. I don't know if anyone likes those, actually, to be honest. But that, you know, the need to build real relationships and connect on real issues. I think so much of the, as I was saying to you before, like so much, there's so much pressure to keep up kind of this perfect facade. And actually, you can, as a leader, male, female, or anything, you can just feel like your house is on fire. And how can we not just transform the face of leadership, but transform what it means to be a leader? It's not about being a bully and an authority. I genuinely believe we're moving away gradually, slowly but surely, away from that. And I think, you know, if you want to motivate teams, if you want to get people behind a vision, you've got to try, you've got to get to the core of what makes them tick and what inspires them. And so it is also about kind of creating a revolution of leadership. And so Uncommon is really built around creating almost a personal board of directors for our members. So they kind of come in, we match them into a peer group that's, again, diverse. So it's industry agnostic, but it's people who have enough kind of shared experience. So they've gone through some part of the leadership journey. So it is vetted in that sense. And then, and then they're matched, you know, based on kind of goals, and it's led by a best in class executive coach who will take them through, various different themes and they kind of meet monthly to keep each other accountable, challenge each other and stay on track on their goals. So it's been a really, really fun journey. And for me, it was important to orient my career towards doing something that would have a lasting impact. Mm-hmm. That's not to say that I don't think it's, you know, I'm building an NGO or something like that. I think it's also an underserved market. And so finding kind of the marriage of the two was really important.
Yeah. Is it open for anyone to sign up or register now?
Yeah, so we are taking applications. I can share the link with you. And so we are we have our first batch of founding members, but we'll be adding members every month. So happy to share that with you.
Yeah. So female in management roles.
Yeah. So that's the. Yeah, we look at the strength, the length, and the impact of your career. And we're looking as well for people who, yes, it is about you developing as a leader, but I think the strength of Uncommon comes from that peer group experience. So we're also looking for people who are wanting to grow together. And also, you know, the cohorts are such a strong experience, I think, because everybody is in that together and they want to see each other succeed. So that's also something we look for. Yeah.
Oh, yeah. Send me the link. More than happy to share with.
Awesome.
Yeah, that's cool. I like that you have a cool slogan, strength, length, and impact.
Yeah.
That's so easy to remember. Yeah. Okay, good one. Yeah. Well, Yolanda, it's been a real pleasure. You know, I learned so much today, actually. I thought I would learn about like your travel experience, but what I really learned is culminated in the fact that, you know, the idea that we're different but we're the same. And it's always worth reminding ourselves of that, because it's so easy in this world now to just be like, I can't relate.
Yeah.
This is not for me. So.
Yeah, and to pick a side. Yeah.
Yeah. Well, thanks so much, Yolanda. I hope we can do this again soon.
Thank you so much for having me. I had so much fun. Thanks. Thank you.